Good afternoon. I'm calling the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 13th. Let the record reflect the time is 1:32. Today we have present Vice Chair Senator Reinbold, Senator Maticki, and Senator Keel, and myself, Chair Senator Hughes. Please silence your cell phones. Thank you for those assisting us today, as you do every day. We have two items on the agenda. The committee will be introduced to SB 12, short title Assault, Sex Offenses, Sentencing, Parole, sponsored by Senator Maticki, and Senate Bill 35, short title Crime, Sex Crime, Sentencing, Parole, from the governor. I've scheduled these two bills together to be heard together because while SB 35 deals with a number of sex crimes related issues, they both, as originally drafted, attempt to correct the loophole within our criminal statutes that allowed for the infamous Justin Schneider case this past year. So, Senator Maticki, if you'd like to approach the table, and if Edra would like to join you, we'll let you get situated and begin your presentation on SB 12.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I am Senator Peter Maticki from District O on the Kenai, and we are here today to present the Justin Schneider Loophole Elimination Act. I know we don't name our bills, but I think it's imperative that we shine a bright light on what we're trying to do to correct what appalled so many Alaskans this year. You have a sponsor substitute before you, which is the result of further research and our discussions with the Department of Law and the administration following introduction of the original bill. The bill has very similar components to some of those contained in the governor's bill, but we felt it was important to have a standalone bill so that it could make its way through the legislature, hopefully this session, highlighting the fact that our desire is that there are no more free passes for such crimes as those that occurred with Mr. Schneider.
Senator Maticki, I want to interrupt just for a minute. So those listening and the committee members realize we're going to be working off of version U, which was read across the floor, just so everyone have the correct version. Okay, continue. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have a wife and four daughters, been active in the domestic violence and sexual assault community in that fight against that scourge in Alaska for many years. And frankly, I was appalled with the results of this case, as so many Alaskans were. Senate Bill 12 eliminates those loopholes in Alaska law that have contributed to the inability to hold perpetrators of sexual assault adequately accountable for their actions. The bill will prove to victims that Alaskans have had enough, and we will stand with them to prosecute and incarcerate sexual predators while creating adequate deterrence for future violent crimes. As you know, we talked about the bill, the issue last fall when a violent sexual predator named Justin Schneider was allowed to walk free without spending any time in jail due to a plea deal that included credit for time he spent on electronic monitoring. He walked free and is not required to register as a sexual predator, sexual offender. His sentence garnered national attention. People were outraged that he was essentially given a free pass for brutally strangling a woman to unconsciousness and then ejaculating on her. The public outcry was even resulted in the unprecedented removal of a judge for decisions made in the case. This is uncomfortable to talk about. We're going to be talking about things that are uncomfortable, and I think it's imperative that we do so, because I want you to put a loved one in that situation and then think about the perpetrator walking free. He was initially charged with kidnapping and first-degree harassment, but the state subsequently decided it would be difficult, if not impossible, to prove the kidnapping charge, so it was dropped. Since unwanted contact with bodily fluid such as semen is not currently categorized as a sex crime under Alaska law, Mr. Schneider eventually pled to second-degree assault. Because of his lack of criminal history, the sentencing range was 0 to 2 years in jail. He received 2 years with one suspended and was given credit for the other year due to time spent on electronic monitoring. So you're probably asking yourself, what does this bill do? Senate Bill 12 will classify unwanted contact with semen as a sexual crime. It will classify masturbation and ejaculating on a person as sexual assault in the third degree, requiring the offender to register as a sexual offender for life. It will require that strangulation to the point of unconsciousness is defined as assault in the first degree, which carries a sentence of 5 to 20 years, and it will eliminate credit toward time served for electronic monitoring. Madam Chair, my staff, Edra Morledge, can go through a sectional analysis of the bill, and folks from the department are here to able to speak to the bill as well. And with that, I'm going to go back to being a member of this committee.
We welcome you back to the committee table. Senator Michicki, thank you for your overview. And just for members to be aware of who we have available to answer questions, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Witt, but because I think they're primarily here for SB 35, but since they're in the room or online, we can still take advantage of them. So we have Deputy Commissioner Mike Duxbury in the room. We have Kathy Monfredo with DPS online, Lieutenant John Brown with DPS online, DOC Ed Webster online, and Matt Davison, Juvenile Justice, with Department of Health and Social Services, and he is here in the room in person. Is that correct? Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Michicki.
If I may, you know, with the various crime bills, particularly in this case, we worked with the administration. The logic in the decisions that were made, I think, are very important. And I know that if you have related questions to the logic of the changes, Mr. Skidmore is very helpful in that area.
Excellent. Ms. Morledge, you're going to do a sectional analysis for us then?
Yes, Madam Chair. For the record, Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Michicki. The sectional analysis will begin with Section 1, obviously. It amends AS 1141-200. Assault in the first degree to add a new subsection 5, which adds that a person who knowingly causes another to become unconscious by means of a dangerous instrument and defines dangerous instrument in accordance with the already existing definition in Alaska Statute 1181-900. Section 2 amends AS 1141-425 subsection A, sexual assault in the third degree, to add subsection 7, which states a person who engages in masturbation and ejaculates on a person without their consent becomes a sexual assault crime in the third degree. Section 3 amends AS 1161-118 subsection A to clarify that the crime of harassment in the first degree, which includes offensive physical contact with human or animal blood, mucus, saliva, semen, urine, vomitus, or feces, is separate from the sex offense, offenses contained in this bill. Section 4 amends 1181-900, subsection B-60, to include in the definition of sexual contact, knowingly causing the victim to come into contact with ejaculate. Section 5 amends AS 12.10.010B to provide for a 10-year statute of limitations for the new crime described in Section 2 of this bill. Section 6 repeals AS 1255.027D, which states that a court may not grant credit against a sentence of imprisonment for time spent in a private residence or under electronic monitoring. Section 7 amends AS 1255-027E to remove electronic monitoring as an option for claiming credit towards a sentence. Section 8 repeals AS 55027G3, which currently allows for sentencing credit for sex crimes. Section 9 is the applicability, and Section 10 is the effective date clause. And I just want to mention for the record that we're still working with the administration and the Department of Law to tighten up the bill just a little bit more. So I think if you are going to have the Department of Law come up, they could perhaps speak to some of the rationale behind some future changes we'd like to see.
Would you suggest that we do that first before we go to questions?
I think that would be good.
Mr. Skidmore, could you join Ms. Morledge at the table and discuss that with us, please?
For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law.
And Ms. Morledge mentioned that you could talk about upcoming changes and why we might be going that direction. I'm not sure what particularly it pertained to. Ms. Morledge, you want to restate that?
Sure, Madam Chair. A couple of the, just to back up for a minute, we had a real quick turnaround on this bill. So it was read across, and then we had a conversation about a couple of items in the bill. One of them is Section 2. It's duplicative. It doesn't need to be there. The next one is Section 3. We'd like to remove, and this pertains to harassment in the first degree, which I mentioned in the sectional. We would like to remove the term semen from that section and have it have becoming in contact with semen be separate and only in this bill as a sexual offense. And then Section 4, change the term ejaculate back to semen, and I think that's probably the part that Mr. Skidmore could explain more thoroughly.
Mr. Skidmore.
Thank you. So just to go over those sections, Section 2, I agree the subsection which is added, subsection 7, to the statute is actually duplicative once you change the definition of sexual contact in Section 4 of the bill. So you're not needing a second additional subsection. I think that was a different concept that had originally been discussed. I think it becomes duplicative, and it's cleaner for that to be removed. That was one of the things we had discussed. Section 3, then, the first language in there that was added, this is on page 3 of the bill, under circumstances not prescribed in the 1141-425A7. That's the section that was proposed to be added, but if you remove it, that language doesn't make sense. The word semen would be removed because it was going to be covered by sexual contact, which is actually then found in Section 4. And our recommendation is in constructing statutes, we always advise the legislature to try and continue to use terms that are already found in statute in other places. Those are terms that have been defined either by case law or that the practitioners are more accustomed to dealing with. Whenever you introduce a new or different term, it begs the question of why is this different? What is this meant to be covering instead of the word that was previously in statute? And so the word that's already in statute, as you see in Section 3, is the term semen. We recommend that that term be used instead of ejaculate just for consistency's sake.
Okay.
Question.
Senator Michicki.
Just to clarify for the record, again, this is not all entirely comfortable to sit here and talk about, but that it sort of stresses the importance of the bill. So in discussions with Ledge Legal, we were concerned, and I remember having this discussion with you as well. Does semen require the presence of sperm, which was our concern on using the term ejaculate, which does not?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, since the time that I had the opportunity to have that discussion with you, I reached out to the crime lab to inquire of them to ensure that we didn't have any issues. And based on my conversation with them, I believe that the term semen is the better term to use. It does not require the presence of spermatozoa. They can test for the substance that's already written into statute, and that's why I recommend you continue to use it by introducing a different term. You're now asking questions of, well, what precisely is that supposed to be referring to? So I would continue with the same term. There are not problems associated with that. Again, that was information that I had in talking with the crime lab, though I don't know that those folks are available today. If that's an issue the committee wanted to address, I'm sure they could be available at a future date.
Thank you.
Senator Akil.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sometimes helps to slow down a little. For me, you, I think, said that by changing the definition of sexual contact to include semen, we did not need to add a section to sexual assault in the third degree because it was duplicative. And I'm not seeing that. Can you help me with where sexual assault in the third degree would handle this only by adding sexual contact or only by changing the definition of sexual contact?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I'd be happy to. If you look on page 2 and section 2, it says that an offender commits the crime of sexual assault in the third degree if the offender engages in sexual contact. So that is one area in which it would be included. The statutes as they already exist in their framework for sexual assault and sexual abuse of a minor, quite frankly, have really three different categories, if you will, of elements. And those categories of elements sort of create a cascading framework of the conduct that is criminalized. Those three areas are the conduct itself, whether it's sexual penetration or sexual contact. You then have the state of the victim themselves, whether it is without consent, whether the victim is mentally incapable or incapacitated or unaware. And then the third category really deals with whether or not there is some sort of other relationship that causes the legislature to want to enact laws with a slightly different level because of that relationship. An example of that relationship would be if this was a parent engaged in that conduct with a child, if this was a coach engaged in that conduct with a student, a teacher with a student, that sort of relationship, that framework of those three concepts, penetration versus contact, the mental state of the victim at the time that the conduct occurs, and then the relationship between those two individuals, those three elements create a rather complex, intricate, but elegant cascading framework of the conduct that's there. So if you were to only try and change one statute by adding a subsection like 7 to it, you are ignoring all of the other framework that exists. By altering the definition of sexual contact, you take advantage of the framework that has been developed over the years that is already in existence, that the case law already understands, and you add the conduct to that so that it stays consistent with what you already have in law.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up, Senator Keel.
Thank you. Helpful. So then this would, within that framework, vary the kind of contact that we're putting into the definition here from what level of offense at the most egregious example to what level of offense at the least horrible.
So through the chair, Senator Keel, sexual contact is found in two different types of crimes. One is sexual assault. The other one is sexual abuse of a minor. For sexual assault, the most serious offense that encompasses contact is sexual assault in the second degree, which is a Class B felony. You then have sexual contact that goes all the way through sexual assault in the fourth degree, which is a Class A misdemeanor. For sexual abuse of a minor, you are likewise going to encounter the term sexual contact first with sexual abuse of a minor in the second degree, which is a Class B felony. And I would have to confirm if that's also all the way down in the fourth degree. I believe it is, but I would want to look at a statute book to confirm that precisely.
Follow-up, Senator Keel.
With your permission, Madam Chair, the sponsor originally talked about, originally introduced the bill, adding it as I think, am I going to miss my notes, C felony at a specific level. So if I could ask the sponsor or the sponsor's staff whether this sort of cascading level of levels of offense fits with their intent and approach.
Certainly. Senator Michicki, would you like to respond? Or
I will let. I'm not sure I understand the question in this case, so perhaps Edra does.
Sure. Through the chair, this is Edra Morledge again. Senator Keel, if I understand your question, you are trying to clarify if adding the definition accomplishes the sponsor's goal. Okay. Of
Madam Chair, could I clarify the question?
Yes, please clarify it.
I think you dropped the bill as a Class C felony. This change would put it on a spectrum from more serious than a Class C to significantly less serious than a Class C, or not somewhat less serious. Is that okay?
Well, there's a mix of charges depending on what occurs in the bill, so that's why I'm struggling with your question a little bit. It goes a series of strangulation being assault in the first degree, so I'm not sure which portion of the law you're asking about, Madam Chair.
Oh, and then I would also add, Mr. Skidmore, because we have other bills that are changing things, and just in general, if there's anything from that's in another bill that would impact this bill, if you could please highlight. I don't know in this case if it does, but then back to Senator Michikis' question.
To the chair, the first thing that I would say is that there is nothing in SB 35 or any other bills that I'm aware of that have been introduced in this session that would impact any of the sentencings that we've talked about. There are other bills that impact felony sentencings for non-sex crimes, but there are no other bills that impact felony sentencing for sex crimes. The changes that are made in 35, which I know we'll discuss when we talk about 35, in no way impact what's being done here in SB 12. There are some provisions of 35 that we'll likely remove because of what's being done in this particular bill, but there's nothing that changes the sentencings that are associated with it. Right. And then second, as to Senator Keel's question, let me see if I can highlight it for you this way. Right now, if you were to take SB 12 and you were simply to stick with the conduct that a person knowingly causes another to become if you look on page 3 and you talk about engage in masturbation and ejaculates on a person without the consent of that person, you completely ignore what about those circumstances that I just pointed out to you earlier in this particular statute, where that victim is mentally incapable or incapacitated or unaware that that conduct is occurring. If you talk about the other concepts with the special relationships, you could have somebody that was in a medical facility receiving treatment or care from the medical staff there, completely unaware because they are under the influence of appropriate medications that are prescribed to them for whatever reason they're in that facility, but they wouldn't be covered by this particular subsection. But by adding it to the definition of contact, all of those other scenarios have already been taken into consideration. And so the risk you run if you simply try and do it this way is that you will miss large portions of the conduct that the legislature has already determined should be criminalized. And does that increase some of the level of this from a C to a B, which I believe is your question? The answer is yes, it does. Mm-hmm. But the legislature's already made the determination that unwanted contact with genitals, anus, or female breast, which is the definition of sexual contact, is already classified as a B felony under the law. And so to try and put everything into that C felony ignores the frameworks that's there, and I would humbly submit to you, may result in unintended consequences of gaps or holes in the law, which I think was the original intent of this bill, was to try and close those, to ensure you don't have that situation of unjust conduct occurring without a true penalty for it. If you were to adopt this without taking that cascading approach, you run the risk of making that same mistake over again, and I'm certain that none of you want to make that mistake.
You have any follow-up, or are you satisfied?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Question.
Senator Michikis.
I'm a little concerned with the removal of semen from 1161-118A. The reason that law was passed was primarily to protect corrections officers and other officers from unwanted contact, offensive contact with human fluids and animal fluids. But would that make, if that were to occur in a corrections facility and someone were to include semen on what they flung, would that make it a sexual assault?
Through the chair, Senator Michikis, the answer to your question simply is yes. Let me provide a little context as to why that may be something that you all want to consider. When you look at, and I know this was a suggestion that I had made about how to approach this, where you tried to separate the two, but once I saw it in writing, it didn't flow appropriately, and I couldn't find a legal way, either from my own analysis or in consulting with other lawyers, I couldn't find a way to differentiate the conduct. That is, how do you differentiate coming into contact with semen in that correctional facility versus coming into contact outside of that situation? What is it that differentiates those two circumstances? And it was difficult to come up with the language that you could articulate that was also susceptible to being able to prove in a court of law. And when I went back to look at the other examples of bodily fluids or substances, human or animal blood, mucus, saliva, urine, vomitus, feces, you look at all of those and you have to stop, and this is one of those uncomfortable conversations, but you have to ask yourself, are any of those other substances produced through sexual activity? And the answer is no. None of them are. So look at the one that still remains on there and ask yourself, can you get that particular substance without some sort of sexual activity? Again, the answer you come to is no, you can't. So it really is of that sexual nature. Does that mean that everyone that engages in that conduct, and just to help the committee, this particular provision of harassment was enacted a number of years ago in response to conduct that was occurring within our state correctional facilities in which we had inmates engaging in this behavior in an attempt to harass and annoy the correctional officers in the facilities. That's why it was never designed to try to address sexual conduct. But when you look at it, that one substance is very different than all of the others listed, and it requires some type of sexual activity to get there. I don't think that you're going to be able to craft a law, and maybe I'm wrong, but I can't find a way to craft a law that separates those two things. I think this really comes down to something that I've told many others in the legislature, and you'll hear me say many more times, that our criminal justice system has to rely on the discretion of those within the system. It is nearly impossible to try and legislate every possible hypothetical situation that you can come up with. It just isn't reasonable. So you have to make your best attempt at it and then trust in the discretion of how the system works thereafter. So would that inmate be asked to register as a sexual offender? Would we prosecute them in a case that requires them to do those things? We'd have to look at the individual facts of that particular case. I find it highly unlikely that we would handle those cases in the same way that we would handle somebody like the Justin Schneider situation again, though.
Senator Michiki?
Follow up to make it further more uncomfortable. Yet, isn't there the potential for urine to contain? I mean, would you see that the sample of what was flung on a corrections officer would go to a lab? And isn't there the potential for trace amounts of semen to be included in urine? And is that some of the details that might be reviewed so that someone was more likely to be charged under offensive physical contact versus sexual assault?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, I am not an expert in that sort of analysis. Those are the sorts of things that I would regularly go to the crime lab and consult with somebody there about. But to answer your question, let's assume hypothetically that you're correct. Let's assume that that's the way the testing could be conducted and you could find some smaller quantity of one substance within the other. Certainly, we would be looking at that to say, what is the core conduct of this? What's really intended here? And I think in those circumstances, we would not be choosing to prosecute that at that higher level. The other thing that I would say that I think really will implicate that and goes more to not just discretion, but to help others feel a little more comfortable, is that for any crime, every crime, you have to have two basic elements. You have to have a mens rea, or the mental element, and you have to have the actus reus, which is the actual act. So the act of flinging this substance on another person, part of what has to happen is it has to be knowing. And knowing is a term that's defined in our statutes. It's Alaska Statute 1181-900, subsection A2, if I'm not mistaken. And knowing says that you actually have to know that that's there. So that inmate who urinates and then flings that urine on another person, they would have to know that that urine contained the semen in order for us to be able to charge them with that higher level crime. And I think that's highly unlikely that we would be able to prove in a prosecution that the person would urinate and know that there was semen in there. So that would prevent us from being able to prosecute it at all. Couldn't bring those charges because it doesn't meet the elements of the crime. And that's one of those difficult things to always keep in mind is those two elements, both the actus reus and the mens rea. The actus reus is pretty straightforward sometimes, but it's that mens rea that's a little trickier, and that's really what protects a lot of conduct that people would have otherwise thought were criminalized.
And I might add, as uncomfortable as this is, I just looked up in the dictionary the word mucus, and it actually would be covered under that word in this kind of a situation, I believe, just based on the common definition of mucus. And I can read that for the record, just so we can see that in the kind of situation you're describing. A vicious, slimy mixture of mucins, water, electrolytes, epithelial cells, and leukocytes that is secreted by glands lining the nasal, esophageal, and other body cavities and serves primarily to protect and lubricate surfaces.
So to answer your question, Senator Hughes, I don't know how the lab would look at that, but I can tell you that when the lab is analyzing substances, they can tell us whether or not this is semen versus something else. So my understanding had always been that they were able to make that differentiation, but again, I am not the expert there. That's a question that I would encourage you to contact the lab, or we can arrange for one of those analysts to be available if you have that question.
Right. I'm just saying that if something is flung and it's not in a, it's being used but not for a sexual act, that I believe that mucus definition, the common definition, is broad enough to cover it. Are we ready to move on, or do you have more thoughts on that, Senator Michicki?
I do think there's one other thing worth discussing, and that there was a little equal protection issue, because this seems, you can be obviously sexually assaulted by a female in this case, and we were worried a little bit about whether or not there is a detectable substance that would be similar to semen from a female, and we ran that down with the state lab, and the fact is there is not. So this is an appropriate avenue to choose in this case, since the detectable substance only is producible by a male.
Okay. Senator Reinbold has been patiently waiting to be called upon. Thank you, Senator Reinbold.
After all, patient, but but anyway, I guess I'm just a little bit frustrated. Probably I same with Senator Keel right now, because Senator version M came out and then U came out. U came out today. I hadn't had a chance to get to the sponsor with either version, M or U, and then we had an overview, and then we've gotten down like 10 rabbit trails. So I'm a little frustrated today, because we were supposed to do high level, and now we're going down not only into the minutia, but a whole bunch of rabbit trails that I'm not sure, you know, within the first 20 minutes or so of hearing a bill is necessary. But anyway, that's the first time I've ever had to state something like that on record, because usually I can keep up pretty good. But this has been a little frustrating for me today. But basically what I wanted to do is, when we were going over the sectionals, is talk about some of the things like Section 6 and some of the other sections. Is this affecting some of the other bills that are, you know, 32, 33, 34, 35, and how it compares with what happened in Senate Bill 91? Because to me, now I'm almost wondering, if, you know, because Senate Bill 91 was passed in an omnibus bill, and now we're going in so many different pathways. What are we capturing, what bills, and what are we capturing in other bills? And I kind of think that's kind of an important issue. But anyway, if you guys can tell me this, granting credit against sentence for imprisonment for a time spent in a private residence or electronic monitoring, that sure sounds familiar, something that I saw in Senate Bill 91 or a similar bill. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, there was a provision of SB 91 that addressed electronic monitoring. What you see on page 4, section 6, does reverse what was there in 91 and puts us back to what was in law prior to SB 91.
Yeah. So,
Senator Reinbold?
Thank you. It's just, trying to see the differences between SB 91 and all these bills. You know, now there's 12 and 30. 233, 34, and 35, I just think is really, really, really important, because we don't want to mess this up. People want SB 91 repealed, clear. It's not working. It's causing epidemic public safety issues right now, and I just think making this as clear and clean as possible. And I've also heard that something in this bill got changed in this version because of the impact with prisoners. And to me, that kind of information is really important. If it went from a felony, I think that's where Senator Keel was going, down to a misdemeanor. I want to know why, you know, and is that exactly what happened?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, there is nothing else in this bill that SB 91 ever touched on. This is completely dealing with the loopholes or the gaps in our law that were highlighted by the Justin Schneider case. There are three things that the bill primarily does. One is dealing with strangulation. The senator has proposed adding another subsection to assault in the first degree for being strangled to unconsciousness. Mm-hmm. That's not something that's ever been in our law before. That's not something that anything's ever touched on before. Second, you're dealing with the unwanted contact with semen. That, again, was nothing that was touched by SB 91. That was a law that had been enacted sometime before. I'd have to look up exactly what the year was, but it was quite some time ago. And then the third thing is this electronic monitoring. And I agree with you. Yes, that is something that was touched on by SB 91, and this does reverse that to where it was prior.
Senator Reinbold?
Through the chair, I know that about the other two. I specifically was referencing Section 6 and 7 of the new summary of Version U in regards to that. And also, I really want to go back because I was told very briefly as I was running to this committee that something was happening in regards, but I never got the story with in regards to prisoners and prisoners throwing urine, and that's why it was changed from a felony to C, but I didn't ever get to talk to anybody to find out what that was, and that kind of information is helpful before we come. So I think Senator Keel was trying to go there with when it got changed from a felony to a misdemeanor, but I'm not exactly sure because no one came and explained anything to me specifically of what happened.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michicki.
So that's I mean, clearly why we're here. This bill isolates four issues that were a specific condition that led to the fact that a violent sexual offender not only served no time, but is not required to be on the sexual offender list. So the four items, and I'm just clarifying why these are broken out. It reclassifies unwanted contact with semen as a sexual crime, which was not able to be charged in the case with Justin Schneider. It classifies masturbation and ejaculating on a person as sexual assault in the third degree, which could not be charged. It was not a crime prior to if this bill passes. Strangulation was a part of this issue that obviously was not something that was able to be brought to, first of all, wasn't in the first degree and was not able to be brought to a conviction. And it eliminates the electronic monitoring, which counted for a year of Mr. Schneider's incarceration, if you will, was given full credit. So he never spent a moment in prison for this heinous crime. So it covers those four things. I'm not sure why nothing in this bill drops down any of the existing crimes to a lower level, which I think is imperative to get on the record. And I'm not really sure where that's coming from.
And I'm a little confused too, so because it's on that very point, because we were trying to figure out there when you were asking your very first question about tiered, about whether we had to move the new version and or whether it reading across the sponsor statement across the floor took care of that technical aspect. So I kind of missed that question, but I'm thinking there's some confusion that something's being dropped from a felony to a misdemeanor, and that is not the case. Can you verify that, please?
Again, for the record, this is John Skidmore, and Senator Hughes, you're absolutely correct. There is nothing in this bill that is reducing a penalty for anything. What you are doing is you are taking conduct that was criminalized as an A misdemeanor under harassment in the first degree. You are adding that conduct to the definition of sexual contact. Sexual contact is found in a series of statutes, both for sexual assault and sexual abuse of a minor. It is taking that Class A misdemeanor, making it a B sex felony, making it a C sex felony, and in some circumstances, keeping it as an A misdemeanor but a sex crime, and that's for that sexual assault in the fourth degree. I'd have to go and look up the exact elements of that particular crime for you, but it's following in that same line. What it does is it takes this conduct and says this is actually sexual in nature, and therefore we are weaving it into the framework that already exists. You are increasing the penalties for the vast majority of it. There is a very slim situation, and I think it's contact. I know there's a contact provision there, and it deals with special relationships, but I don't remember precisely the language. I can look up at a statute if you...
Are you talking about the one that is the misdemeanor?
Yes, I'm talking about the one that would be a misdemeanor, which is sexual assault in the fourth degree. But the primary conduct where this would be occurring, the Justin Schneider situation, would have been a sexual assault in the third degree, which would have made it a Class C felony that was a sex offense that carries a penalty of 2 to 12 years as opposed to 1 year maximum for harassment.
If you have it handy and you can look it up, since we're talking about it, we'll take it at ease while you look it up. I'm calling the Senate Judiciary Committee back to order, and I've asked Mr. Skidmore to look up the and describe to us what is the misdemeanor. If you could continue with that conversation, please.
To the Chair, Senator Hughes, Alaska Statute 1141-427 is sexual assault in the fourth degree, and it is classified as a Class A misdemeanor. There are five different subsections to this particular statute, but it deals with while employed at a correctional facility or another place designated by the Commissioner of Corrections for the custody and care of prisoners, the offender engages in sexual contact with the person who the offender knows is committed to the custody of the Department of Corrections. So this would be the corrections officer who would engage in this conduct with somebody that was in DOC. That's classified as an A misdemeanor currently in law. That's an example of where that would still be an A misdemeanor. The second subsection talks about the same thing, only instead of DOC, it's talking about the Department of Health and Social Services, particularly a juvenile offender that is 18 or 19 in age. It's limited to those two ages for the victim, and again, it's engages in that is the legal guardian of the offender. Is the legal guardian of the person to whom you do this to. That is also classified as a sexual assault in the fourth degree. That's sexual contact again. The third subsection talks about being a peace officer in the state and having sexual contact with a person with reckless disregard to the fact that that person is in the custody or apparent custody of the law enforcement officer. Again, that is a Class A misdemeanor. This is the way that's all classified currently in law. This bill is not changing any of that. This is just folding these concepts into that. So if you had sexual penetration for any of those, that would have been the Class C felony. This is sexual contact, which is a Class A misdemeanor. That's the way the law classifies it currently. All you're doing is folding into that this conduct. At the highest level, again, you're talking about engaging in this conduct with someone that is without their consent. That would be a B sex felony under our laws. If you engage in that conduct with someone that is mentally incapable, incapacitated, or unaware, you are committing a C sex offense under our laws. So this is increasing the penalty. For Justin Schneider, you literally would have gone to... And I said the maximum was a year under our laws. I think the presumption was 30 days. You would go from a 30-day sentence to a 2 to 12-year sentence under the bill that Senator Michicki is proposing.
Senator Reinbold.
Okay, and thank you for that. That was helpful, and I think that's why we have to get this right, because we had a case in Eagle River where a peace officer, basically a police officer, was having sexual conduct with people in the town hall, and it frustrates me to no end that it's a Class A misdemeanor when foolishly in SB 91 it went from 0 to 365 days, which I think that should have been misdemeanor A's.
And
Can I finish?
Go ahead.
Okay. So anyway, I just think that being a misdemeanor, A, would have bothered me. Maybe that was one of the exemptions in SB 91, but this is the kind of thing for my community that's very, very, very important, because misdemeanor A is pretty little, in my opinion, for somebody in custody of law enforcement and making, conduct with a victim or in their custody. Just to me, that should be a felony, but maybe that's something I want to look at as an amendment.
You have a response, Mr. Skidmore?
I was just going to say, through the chair to Senator Reinbold, I would need to go back and look at the statute to see if that exemption applies, but I know that for most assaults, that 30-day did not apply. Harassment did not fall into that category. I believe the sexual assaults would. I would need to verify that, but either way, the point for this is that you're increasing the sentence for all those circumstances. And I recognize if somebody says they don't like the way sexual assault in the fourth degree reads right now, I understand that concept, but that's the way the statute is now. That was not changed by any criminal justice reform bill that's come through in the last several years. So that's a separate conversation than I think what's in front of us with SB 12.
And when I asked earlier if this hinges on anything else, any of the crime package out there, these things, the sexual crimes were excluded from some of the sentence reductions in SB 91. Is that correct?
To the chair, Senator Hughes, that's absolutely correct.
Okay. That's a good clarification. I want to talk. Oh, Senator Reinbold.
But not all of them.
So through the chair, Senator Reinbold, where this becomes complicated is that there are a few statutes that people think of as sexual in nature, but that were not classified as sex crimes under our sentencing statutes. I would have to go and try and provide specific examples of it, but that's a lot of what's trying to be addressed in SB 35, which we'll get to later today.
Okay, thank you. Senator Michiki.
I didn't want to interrupt you, Madam Chair. But
well, I want to go on to a different topic, so if you have something on that.
I still think we need to clarify the question. I mean, you say this is, we work in an interesting environment, and there are, apparently rumors flying that we've reduced something. Can you just one more time explain that on the crime of harassment under 1161.118A, semen used to be included as the kind of fluid. What we've done is increased the seriousness by removing it and pulling it into the sexual assault statutes and out of the harassment statutes. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, that's absolutely correct. There is nothing here that is reducing a penalty. This is increasing the penalties.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to talk about on page 2, lines 4 through 6, having to do with the strangulation. Mm-hmm. This section adds an element that's a serious concern when a victim is strangled, and sometimes to the point of consciousness. And I was wondering how a person being unconscious, can that be easily proved? I'm concerned that if that is part of it, it's you have an action of the strangulation occurring, and then the effect being possible unconsciousness, maybe not unconsciousness. So if unconsciousness isn't coupled, then the person couldn't be charged with this. And so I'm just wondering why we're adding the element of unconsciousness to it, because if you think about from the victim's perspective, if they're not actually taken to the point of unconsciousness, it's actually a scarier thing. It may not be medically and physically more dangerous, but it's a horrific thing. So I'm just wondering why we need the element of unconsciousness in here, or would it work not to have that? I'm also concerned about how you prove that after the fact. Unless a person were to go to be examined within a 24-hour period or something, it becomes a he said, she said. And if in the courtroom unconsciousness can't be proven, then I'm concerned this charge wouldn't stick.
To the chair, first, what I would want to assure everyone and explain is that a assault in the second degree has not been altered or changed in any way, shape, or form. And an assault in the second degree is where we normally prosecute strangulation cases today. The assault in the second degree talks about causing somebody, you're assaulting them with hands or other objects where you're impeding either the breathing or circulation. What's changed in SB 12 is adding the concept that you are causing someone to become unconscious by means of a dangerous instrument. Dangerous instrument includes choking somebody or strangling them with your hands. So it's already covered when you have that lower level conduct. What this would do is create a second tier to say when you are strangling someone and you strangle them to the point of unconsciousness, there is now a higher penalty associated with it. That having been said, I agree with you that proving someone has lost consciousness will not necessarily be an easy or straightforward thing. Does that mean that it can't be done? No, of course not. There are things that we would look at and that we would attempt to do to try and reach that level. But when you talk about losing consciousness, the information that we have about losing consciousness is that it takes a small amount of pressure and that it can happen fairly quickly. Quickly within a number of seconds, less than a minute. And so it is the sort of thing that from my experience, and I guess I've been prosecuting now about 21 years, I have prosecuted a number of strangulation cases, and I have had those cases in which victims report that they lost consciousness. They will describe to you that the world began to close in on them and they began to lose perspective of where they are. You will have situations in which the person will say, geez, I was being attacked and I was in the living room and the next thing I knew, I was in a different room and I don't know how I got there. Those are the sorts of things that prosecutors would have to look at and evaluate and determine, are there a sufficient number of those sorts of details, of that type of evidence that would allow us to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that the person lost consciousness. And if we're successful in that, we will have convicted somebody of that higher level of offense. If we cannot prove that it was to the point of unconsciousness, there is still the assault in the second degree of which the person could be convicted, and there would still be consequences for that.
Okay, and so this particular change in law is not particular to sexual crime, so it could be just a case of violence and a situation where there's no sexual crime involved. Is that correct?
To the chair, Section 1 does not require the crime to be sexual in any nature. It is merely talking about the conduct of strangling another person, and it's strangling them to the point of unconsciousness. That's all that Section 1
does. And familiarize me, in the Justin Schneider case, was he charged with strangulation as one of the charges that
yes.
against him?
It was charged as an assault in the second degree. He pled to the crime of assault in the second degree.
Okay, thank you. This is Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so one, I just want to do a little shout out for John Novak in regards to, you know, that he is focusing on the strangulation. That apparently there's eight times, I believe it is, that the chance that they'll kill somebody if they've been involved in a strangulation. So I think, you know, although I disagree with him on several things, that's one thing that I thought was important that he was going to prioritize in regards. I didn't even realize that risk until I saw it in the newspaper the other day. But in regards to this section, what concerns me is that people want specifics. They want law to be clear, you know, so there's no loopholes. To me, I mean, hands aren't necessarily considered an instrument or a dangerous instrument. I just want to know if there's any possible loopholes or if it's the time to clarify that right now. To ensure that if hands are used or feet are used or anything is used for strangulation, since, you know, because it's such a high-risk case with a chance of these people eventually murdering people.
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, the definition, and I apologize, I'm trying to describe it generally for you. Let me be more specific to help you understand. It's Alaska Statute 1181-900 subsection B14 sub B that says hands or other objects when used to impede normal breathing or circulation of blood by applying pressure to the throat or neck or obstructing the nose or mouth that is when they are considered a dangerous instrument. It's specifically about the way in which they are used that makes them a dangerous instrument.
So it could be a pillow, Senator Reimbold.
So there's nothing that you would recommend at this time to ensure these people don't get away, or is there no ambiguity in the law at this time?
Through the chair, Senator Reimbold, my experience and the experience of those that I've talked with in my department don't indicate to me that there's a problem with that definition or how we've been applying it.
Okay. Follow up on that point.
Senator Michicki.
So I when this was circulating and ever since, you know, folks were wondering why Justin Schneider wasn't charged with attempted murder for the strangulation. And we know that when you strangle someone to the point of unconsciousness, you're literally seconds away from potentially killing that person. So is there an existing law? Was it intent that perhaps was missing in that case? Or is there a case where strangulation is already protected under the law as attempted murder if the intent can be proven?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, you're correct that the crime of attempted murder is one that talks about very specifically that mens rea, that intent, that conscious objective to cause a result. And the conscious objective and the result that has to be caused for attempted murder is you have to have the conscious objective to kill somebody. You can engage in all sorts of behavior that is very dangerous, that is very alarming, that is very concerning, that has the potential to kill somebody. But if you are not intending to cause their death, that is not a crime of attempted murder. The second part of your question was, are there circumstances, are there factual patterns in which someone could engage in strangulation or other conduct and they could be charged with attempted murder? The answer is yes. But the prosecution would need to be able to prove what the conscious objective of that individual was. In Mr. Schneider's case, that evidence was not available. There was no evidence to suggest that he was attempting to kill her. There are other cases in which we could certainly say just when someone is strangling another person, their objective was to kill them. Yes, I can envision a number of cases in which that evidence would be available and we could charge that crime.
Just a follow-up.
Senator Michicki.
So on that point, in this case, without having the ability to prove the intent for murder in this strangulation case, the fact that in this case or another hypothetical case, if you were to strangle someone to the point of unconsciousness and then sexually assault them, not only would there be the crime of strangulation without the intent, so you don't have to prove intent to cause the person to become unconscious. The fact that you're strangling them long enough for them to become unconscious is sufficient.
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, again, we're talking about that concept of mens rea, and subsection 5 that's being added on page 3 specifically chooses the mens rea of knowingly, not of intent, and those are very different. You know that you are engaging in conduct that is of a certain nature or a certain circumstance. You know that you are doing something that causes somebody to become unconscious. That's very different than saying you are intending to kill somebody.
Thank you.
And just, and you've probably said it, but the assault in the first degree, the strangulation with the unconscious state, is that, what classification is that? I just don't remember what you said.
To the chair, I have not discussed that, but assault in the first degree is a Class A felony.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I have another question just regarding the statute of limitations on page 3. And can you clarify what has that 10-year limit? And it looks like all other crimes have 5. And I'm wondering if that's pretty similar to what other states have as far as statutes of limitations.
To the chair, Senator Hughes, I'm not familiar with what all the other states' statutes of limitations are. And the particular subsection that you're referring to on the statute of limitations is?
Maybe I was in the wrong. On page 4.
Got it.
4, section 5, starting on line 9.
So I can tell you that in our state, the statute of limitations, this is at 1210.110, it's generally that there is a There are certain crimes that have no statute of limitations, like murder and certain sexual assaults, and in the highest degree. This one is adding Alaska Statute 1141-425, which is assault in the third degree, to a 10-year. So let me just compare that to the book for a moment. So to answer your question, there is a 5-year statute of limitation for most offenses. It is then provided for 10 years for a certain list of offenses, and then there is another set of offenses for which there is no statute of limitations.
So in broad terms, the more heinous crimes against a person would be no limitations, and then we have some pretty serious ones at 10?
Correct.
And then the less serious at 5, is that?
Yes, that is a general description of it. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. That is adequate, and seeing no other questions, we will set this bill aside for now and move on to our second item on the agenda. Oh, Senator Keel.
I had one.
You did have one. Okay.
I apologize, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And it's on our least favorite part of the bill.
Okay. Go ahead. Last question.
I should actually.
And this bill will be back up, so there will be additional opportunities, especially since we didn't have a whole lot of time before the meeting to study the sponsor substitute. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I should actually have started my very first question by thanking Senator Machicki for bringing this forward. I think, on the whole, it is a good and important piece of legislation. I want to kind of get back to the question of our approach to that harassment and contact with semen situation. I guess I am concerned, and as the Senator said, thinking about this takes our minds to places that are not at all pleasant. I'm concerned that there are situations, criminal situations, where someone is assaulted and there is contact with semen that just aren't sex crimes. They are disgusting criminal behavior, but aren't the sort of thing for which we would put someone on a registry. The context of assaults in a prison came up. Criminal behavior from which we should be protecting our correctional officers. If we take this approach of any knowing contact with ejaculate is in the sex crime world, are we dealing with those appropriately? I mean, and you know, we could sit here and tell horrible stories, some of which I've actually heard from COs about pillowcases and what's scooped from the toilet. We have to deal with it criminally, I agree. Is there a way to separate out what I think the Senator wants to address, which is a sex crime, and the conduct he's described, the reason he brought this bill forward that person belongs on the sex offender registry, from some of these assaults that definitely deserve criminal sanction but aren't sexual predation or sexual satisfaction. They are assaults.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I come back to the concept of the particular substance that we're discussing here can only be created through a sexual act. All of the other substances, the example of the pillowcase scooping things out of the toilet, all of the other substances that are listed there do not require a sexual act to create them. So that's in my mind the piece that differentiates it. To the extent that you're asking, is there another way to draw a line between that conduct. Yeah. What I indicated earlier is that I have looked at this and unfortunately thought about this for a significant period of time, trying to find a way to create that distinction or separation, knowing that that could be an issue that folks were concerned about. I failed to do so at this time. I cannot come up with a way that appropriately separates the two that allows us still to be able to prosecute those sex offenses. And what I come back to is where I started. that the conduct requires a sexual act in the beginning, and that in and of itself should be what drives the conversation.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I've spent enough time in a terrible mental state thinking about hypotheticals here, but might have some ideas for how it could be drafted so that we don't have any loopholes, but that we also don't put people on the sex offender registry for assaults that are non-sexual. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
I know you want to get to the other bill, so I'm going to save my question, but I think this is important because I kind of got there with Mr. Skidmore. I think the discretion of the courts would separate the two types of there. I think there is contact with semen in a prison setting with a guard that would clearly be a sexual assault, and I think there are cases where it might be the lesser crime, and I believe that it protects the discretion of the court on these. It does not require being charged at the higher level if it happens to be another situation as opposed to an inmate actually choosing to direct that bodily fluid onto a corrections. And I don't think it should matter if it's a big strapping guy in a prison or a helpless woman in an alley. I think it remains a crime, and it is a crime under those conditions. So I can understand. He has gotten me there in that logic, and we can discuss it further, Madam Chair, at the next meeting, I suppose.
Yes, and again, as I pointed out, the definition of mucus, if you took the semen out, I think it still fits under there, so it would be a place where they could go in addition to just knowing the difference.
Brief at ease.
So we're going to take a brief at ease, and if we can get those that are going to present on SB 35 can come up while we're taking that at ease. Calling the Senate Judiciary Committee back to Senate Bill 35, Crimes, Sex, Crimes, Sentencing, Parole. And this is one of the governor's four proposed bills, as you know, to deal with the high rate of crime in our state. And this one deals specifically with sex crimes. And as you know, we have the worst rates in that area in the nation. So we look forward to hearing the governor's proposal. And we'll hear a bill introduction by the Attorney General Designee Kevin Clarkson. And then we have DPS Commissioner Amanda Price and Corrections Commissioner Dahlstrom. And once they've concluded their opening remarks, if we have time, we'll ask John Skidmore, Director of the Criminal Division, to walk us through whatever we can get through. So let's see how far we go. And I do thank the three of you for your patience as we work through some of the weeds in SB 12. So welcome. Please place your name on the record and begin.
Thank you very much. I'm Attorney General Designee Kevin Clarkson. And Madam Chair, no need to apologize for the time you took. It's very important work you're doing. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here to speak to you about SB 35 and, unfortunately, the very disturbing rate of sexual assault that we have in Alaska. You all know the rising crime rates that we've had in general, but we continue to have unacceptable sexual assault rates in Alaska. And very sadly, Alaska Native females have the highest victimization rate of any gender or racial group, comprising 42% of all sexual assault victims in Alaska. The median age of an assault victim is 19 years. The most common age was 15 years. Those are pretty sad statistics for our state. Most often, the offender was known to the victim. It was only in 2.5% of incidents that a suspect was a stranger to the victim. And when the victim was under 18, it was only 0.3% of incidents where the suspect was a stranger to the victim. That means that our young Alaskan women are being assaulted by men that they knew. That's a sad state of affairs. Mm-hmm. So Governor Dunleavy's introduction of SB 35 is designed to address several things with respect to sex offenses in Alaska. The first one you've spent a great deal of time discussing, so I'm not going to go into in detail on that, but that's to fill the gaps that were discovered in the Justin Schneider case. So just in very summary, SB 35 is very similar to the bill that Senator Michicki has introduced, because the holes in the law that existed allowed Justin Schneider to receive a punishment that was well below what most in the community thought he should have received. So SB 35 makes causing unwanted contact with semen a sex offense, which increases the possible sanctions for the crime and provides authority for appropriate monitoring and registration. So the new law will allow the court to order sex offender treatment for someone who does what Justin Schneider did. It will allow the court to order sex offender registration for someone who does what he did. And it will increase the possible jail time for the first offense from 30 days to 2 to 12 years. It also increases the sentencing for strangulation, which is an assault in the second degree, from 0 to 2 years to 1 to 3 years. And then also, significantly, like Senator Michicki's bill, it will eliminate crediting for pretrial monitoring against the ultimate sentence. So unlike Justin Schneider, who spent so much time on electronic monitoring pretrial, that by the time he got to being convicted, he didn't have any sentence left to serve in jail, that will eliminate that possibility. But SB 35 also seeks to strengthen our sex offense crimes laws in other ways. It increases penalties for sexual predators who target our children. So for example, it increases the penalty for sexual abuse of a minor in the third degree when the age difference between the offender and the victim is at least 6 years. It will leave the penalty the same when the age difference is only 4 to 5 years and the victim is 13, 14, or 15. The law will make solicitation of a minor a felony in all circumstances. So it will make it illegal to ask a child to engage in sexual conduct regardless of the method of communication, whether it's a note, a phone call, or an in-person conversation, or any other means. Current law makes it a crime only to engage in sexual conduct via computer, so we're filling gaps in that respect. The law makes indecent viewing or photographing of a child a registrable sex offense. This is where someone puts a camera in a place where the child doesn't know that the photographing is taking place, and they don't consent to being photographed without their clothing. So we're addressing that situation. SB 35 will also seek to eliminate encouragement of registered sex offenders outside of Alaska to come to Alaska. Under our prior law, or our existing law, excuse me, someone who's required to register as a sex offender outside of Alaska only has to register in Alaska if the sex offense they committed that required registration outside of Alaska matches the sex crime that we have in Alaska. SB 35 would require that individual who's required to register outside of Alaska as a sex offender to register in Alaska, period. If they're required to register somewhere else, they're required to register in Alaska. And under the law, any prior felony, regardless of how old that prior felony is, or whether that felony was sexual in nature, it will count when determining the presumptive sentencing range for the sex offender. So the governor's crime package, including SB 35, attempts to reset the stage on criminal justice. We really have to address the unacceptable sexual assault rates that we have in Alaska. We truly need to do better in our efforts to protect Alaskan women and children from sexual assault. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Commissioner Price.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Amanda Price, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Public Safety. It is my true pleasure to be here before you presenting and speaking on behalf of the Department of Public Safety in support of Senate Bill 35. I would like to take just a brief moment and acknowledge something that many members here today have already acknowledged, Senator Michicki, firstly. But this is a very difficult conversation, and the words that we use and the images that are brought to our minds are not something that are comfortable. And I would like to thank each of the members of the committee, each individual who is coming forward to testify, and each public member who will come forward to testify for engaging in this conversation, because not only is the making of the law critically important, but also the culture that surrounds the topic of sexual violence in our state needs to be changed. And all of us, all of you, everyone in this room and everyone participating and addressing these difficult conversations sends a clear message that we are changing the culture around that topic of sexual violence. So thank you so much for doing that. As we know and will be continued to be repeated a multitude of times, Alaska has incredibly unacceptable rates of sexual violence. One would argue that any rate of sexual violence is unacceptable. In Alaska, our astronomically high rates obliterate that which other states see. We know that we experience this at rates that far exceed what other communities face. The crime of sexual violence does not know any boundary. We know that certain races are disproportionately impacted. That is a statistical fact here in our state. However, there is no socioeconomic status. There is no race, no ethnicity. There is no category of individual that is not impacted by sexual violence in Alaska. Senate Bill 35 strengthens public safety across Alaska by not only closing the loopholes that we have all addressed already today, and I assume you will continue to have conversations about. It also ensures that Alaska is no longer a state that registered sex offenders can escape the acknowledgement of their crime by moving to. And I want to acknowledge that I anticipate a question about the number of registered sex offenders. Is this really something that Alaska faces? And yes, it is. Our Bureau Chief Kathy Monfrida, who I believe is on the line, did pull some data, and our department did a best guesstimate in a short-term period of time that they receive and field between 8 and 10 phone calls per month from individuals inquiring about whether they would have to register as a sex offender if they move to Alaska. I feel as if that statement and that piece of data is critical for all of us to understand the implication of. Registered convicted sex offenders who are actively looking to move to a state that they may not have to register in. Why would that be? SB 35 strengthens and enhances our ability to hold sexual offenders accountable, and it also takes into account the world that we live in today. It identifies ways that we know victims can be hurt today, and it criminalizes that conduct, for example, unsolicited photographs of genitalia. We know that that sort of behavior occurs. We understand now that that is a facet of the technology that is available to us. We have heard anecdotal stories of photos of such a nature being sent. SB 35 gives an opportunity for an individual who unsolicited and unwanted photos of genitalia, who is receiving those photos, it gives them a mechanism to engage with law enforcement, and it gives us as a community, as a state, an opportunity to provide some protection to that individual. We also know that crimes against children across the board in our state, the sheer statistics are devastating. They devastate our communities. This bill enhances protections for Alaskans, particularly Alaskan children, in several ways, continuing to give law enforcement the tools necessary to support and improve public safety through our communities. For example, as the Attorney General designee mentioned, SB 35 introduces a new crime, enticement of a minor. The introduction of this crime, which removes the designation that the enticement of a minor be online, responds to the reality and the fact that Alaskan children are enticed by predators in all arenas, not just online, and it allows for any and all enticement of a minor to be criminalized, giving law enforcement the tools to intervene before a child is hurt. The Department of Public Safety emphatically supports not only SB 35, but also the governor's commitment to responding to and preventing crimes of sexual assault and abuse, holding those offenders accountable, and strongly believes that this bill will, in fact, support and improve public safety. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and have Commissioner Dahlstrom give her overview, and then if we have time for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. It's good to be here before you today. I am Nancy Dahlstrom, Commissioner Designee from Department of Corrections. I am here as a member of our public safety team, and I do have online a gentleman by the name of Ed Webster to answer questions. Thank you.
And Senator Reinbold has a question.
So I know we only have, what, 15 or so minutes left. What I'm going to do is just put a series of questions through the chair on the line so you can be ready for next time, if that's okay. Just some high-level things. But first of all, I want to say thank you, guys. You did come to my office. I did get a thorough overview of this bill, and I really like it very, very much. So I really want to say thank you because that's really important to me. I was going to make a comment to Commissioner Designee Price that I voted no on the previous commissioner, Walt Monaghan, because when he came to my office, he said only 1% of rapists in Alaska end up in jail, and it was like there was no plan to fix that. And that means 99% of the rapists are out there on the streets, and I don't know, it just terrifies me knowing how many people I know in this, born and raised here, and there was no plan to fix it. So I just, from the depths of my heart, I'm just so thankful for this bill. I really, really am, and I want to do whatever I can to get this, you know, to the finish line as quickly as possible. But if there's any big things that we need to fix, I want to do it, you know, now. But I ask some victims, like and prosecutors, of some of the reasons why women didn't bring, you know, their rape cases forward, or, you know, decided not to press charges. And there was some of them said because of things that happened in the courtroom. And I can't remember the court rule number, but I just want to make sure that they didn't want graphics, you know, of themselves, you know, in the courtroom. So if you could, if we could address that at some time, and if you need a more in-depth question, I just want to make sure that women and girls and whoever are empowered to press charges and are protected in the courtroom. So that's one thing I would like at a further discussion. I also want to discuss misdemeanor A's and peace officers and having sexual contact. That is a huge issue in my community because our police station got shut down because of abuse of a peace officer. And I think with a community of 30,000 people, we don't have an ER. It's just awful that we don't have something in Chugiak, Eagle River, you know, to a safe, you know, like a police station. So, you know, knowing there's lack of a trust there. Another thing I would like to discuss is the crime lab. There was a pretty horrible crime lab audit that I was actually losing sleep over because it was such a tragic. And I know John Novick, I believe, was the lawyer there, and I have red flags there. But it was just a real serious issue for me that it was just a scathing audit. I want to know that cases aren't going to get dropped, and you know, because of you know, lack of integrity in our crime lab. I really want to have the opportunity. The sexual assault kits, I don't know how many bills and how many millions of dollars we throw on that. Are they all caught up? And if not, why? Why in the world are our sexual assaults, you know, kits not processed is beyond any comprehension in my book. Next, shelters, safety shelters for people, even if it's a home in villages where women can go. They just feel like they have no way to escape, and I've been looking into this issue far more. And then the witnesses, they might be family members, just what the dynamics are in villages for prosecuting sex crimes. It's pretty horrific, that some of the things that I've looked into, and it doesn't seem like there's a path forward. So anything we can do to expose, to educate, and to empower, especially women and children, of this is just something I want to partner with any of y'all, you know, in order, in any nonprofits, anybody out there. And one last thing, the sex trafficking. Anything we can do to strengthen those sex trafficking laws, and see what's happening in our state. I just can't even believe that it's happening in our state. And I would be in complete denial, but some of the stories that I've heard are just unimaginable. So if there's anything we can do, why this really good bill is before us, and I know that was quite a bit of information there, but just so we can set the stage for a meeting. And thank you, Chair Hughes, for letting me go through my list. I appreciate it.
That's actually a really great list, and I look forward to your discussing those topics. Are there any closing comments or
questions?
Quick questions from Senator Michicki.
Thank you for them to take away, perhaps. Mr. Clarkson, when you talked about the photo of the underage, you said without consent, but I don't believe an underage minor has the potential to give consent for a photo. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, but I'm going to let John Skidmore answer that
okay.
question for you.
For the record, this is John Skidmore, the director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. I wish it was a straightforward answer, Senator Machicki. It's not. The crime of indecent viewing says that a person under the age of 16 must have parental consent, but the person over the age of 13 must also consent. So you have an overlap, 13, 14, 15, 16, excuse me, 13, 14, 15, in which you have to have both the parent and the child consent. If you're under the age of 13, it's only the parent that has to consent. But over the age of 13, I apologize, this probably sounds confusing, over the age of 13 requires the consent of the individual. So there are circumstances. It's a little different because when you talk about sexual abuse of a minor, we say people under a certain age can't consent, period, to that sexual contact or that sexual activity. In this particular statute, it's not about that activity of contact or penetration. It's about the taking of the photo, and it requires both parental and the juvenile's consent for some of them, just parents for some, and just the individual for a third category.
Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, I'm going to need a lot more explanation on that, because that the viewing post the photograph could clearly become a crime.
Mm-hmm.
After the production of, I need more time on that, because that just sounds.
It's a complicated statute.
Yes.
And it also sounds troubling, because mm-hmm. if a parent is giving consent for a 13-year-old to have that kind of photography done, seems like that should be, the parent should be charged with something.
So I agree. But the other question, on the out-of-state registry becoming required within the state of Alaska,
mm-hmm.
Is that the requirement for a new entrant, or can that be a retroactive application for those required to be registered outside to register today, even if they've lived here for X amount of time?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, this is John Skidmore once again. We can get into more details when we do the sectional, but the short answer is that would apply to folks that come in from this point forward. It would not be applied retroactively to people that were already here.
Madam Chair, he keeps giving me that answer on the retroactivity, and I'm not sure I love it, but thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, and I have questions, as I'm sure Senator Keel, Senator Reinbold have more, but we thank you for being with us today and getting us started on this important piece of legislation. And with that, we will pick up with you, Mr. Skidmore, for this sectional analysis on Friday. And that concludes our business today. Yes, Friday. This is Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn and let the record reflect it is 3:04.